Welcome to another Gaming and Destination Celebrity Spotlight brought to you by our friends at North Star Mohican Casino Resort. We're excited to catch up with one of the most respected and successful comedians in modern history, Jeff Foxworthy, who happens to be the largest selling comedy recording artist in history, multiple Grammy Award nominee, and best-selling author of 26 books. Widely known for his redneck jokes, his acts go well beyond that to explore the humor in everyday family, interactions, and human nature. He's currently on tour and heading to several casinos along the way, including a stop at North Star Mohican Casino, located about an hour west of Green Bay, Wisconsin, on August 20th. You can find his full tour schedule at jefffoxworthy.com, and for a full list of dates, be sure to check that out. So, without further ado, Jeff Foxworthy. Jeff, welcome.
Thank you, Doug. It's nice to be had.
So, going through that long list of accolades, does it ever get old hearing all of them?
You know, it's kind of funny when you're in the middle of doing all of that, it doesn't really sink in, you know, because I sit there and go, hey, God, 26 books is a lot of books, you know, or, yeah, that was a lot of records. But when you're in the middle of it, you know, when you look back, you're like, dang, I was busy there for a while.
Absolutely. Well, I'm sure when you read it, it's definitely an eye-opening experience. You've been through a lot. And at some point, does it ever get hard to come up with new content? Like, where do you find some of your creative inspiration before you actually go out and use it?
You know what? I think I'm one of the lucky comedians because real early in my career, I discovered what worked best for me. And that was, I just trusted, hey, if I think something or my wife says something or my family does something, I'm going to trust that other people are thinking and saying and doing the same things that we are. And, you know, to me, when I'm on stage, to see people laugh and then elbow the person next to them or point to the person next to them. And sometimes it's funny. It's like I did a thing on the last special. I was working with Larry the Cable Guy talking about we have a generation that doesn't know how to get dog poop off their shoes. And I'm like, but, you know, we played outside every day. Every day somebody stepped in dog poop. And I went through what you did. You know, you scraped it on the edge of the curb and then you went back and forth in a puddle and got the, and then you did the sweeping motion on the grass. And then you got a little piece of stick and you sat down on the curb and picked it out of the, and as I'm describing it, I'm thinking there's not one joke in this. There's not a joke. And people are gut laughing because they're going, oh my God, I've done that. I've done that. I've done that. And so that's kind of what I've always done. I've talked about my life. And if you go back and listen to an album or watch a special, it's kind of a snapshot of whatever was going on in my life that year.
So would you say that most of your content is original from you? And has it kind of always been that way? Or do you see, like, I hear songwriters and stuff get inspiration from different people or writers doing some of their content from your shows and your content? Is that Jeff Foxworthy original most of the time?
Yeah, almost always. I've got a buddy in Nashville that he's really funny, but he doesn't go on the road or anything. But as I think of things, I'll call him and go, hey, do you think this has merit to it? And if he likes it, then I'll go on up at a club and start working it out. It is kind of amazing if you never get to the point to where you know whether something's funny or not. I mean, if you and I were going to a club tonight and you said, if I had a stack of note cards with ideas on them and you said, pick the four best, two of them would probably die. You know, I mean, I still don't have it down, but that's part of what just amazes me. And I guess keeps me coming back to stand up out of everything I've ever done. I love the fact that you can't figure it out.
So going to a show, and not having, you know, index cards full of what you're going to do, how much, when you go on the stage, how much of your show is scripted, and do you adjust that based on the moods or reactions from the crowd and audience?
Yeah, you know, I always know where I want to start, and I know where I want to finish, and then as you get out there, I guess it's probably like a boxer, is you're kind of saying, all right, are they younger, older? Is it more couples? You know, are they, and you're trying, it's like a little dance. And so it's never the same way twice, but knowing where you want to start and knowing where you want to end, it for me, that was always kind of that security blanket. And sometimes it didn't end up that way, but you know, that's kind of my plan when I walk out there.
So you were part of one of the original, well, maybe not the original, modern day fraternities of comedy with the blue collar comedy crew that included you and Ron White, Larry the Cable Guy, and Bill Engvall. Am I missing anybody there?
No, that's the guy. You know, that started up when the Kings of Comedy tour started up. One of the first stops was Atlanta, where I live, and I was reading about it in the paper, and it said that it was a show for the urban hip audience. And I remember calling up Bill Engvall, and I said, you know, urban and hip leaves a lot of people out, because we've been on the road nonstop for 20 years. And I said, we need to do a show for everybody else. And he kind of laughed, and he said, what would you call it? I said, yeah, call it the Blue Collar Tour. And so we all set 3 months aside, me, Bill, Ron, and Larry, and we were going to try this for 3 months, and I think we ended up doing the first tour for 3 years. We just had no idea that it was going to blow up like that. But it's still to this day one of the most fun things I've ever been part of.
Did you find yourself writing new content along that tour, bouncing ideas across the room with you four? Probably had many of magical moments.
Oh yeah, well you know, and part of the reason it was the four of us was, we all kind of started around the same time, and so we were buddies back in those early days when nobody was making any money, and we just had all remained friends over that time. And so, yeah, in fact, when we pitched the idea of doing the four of us, the promoter wanted to do a big number at the end, something, you know, like a silly song or something, and being not only a comic, but being a fan of comedy, I remember growing up watching the Carol Burnett Show, and my favorite thing was when they made each other laugh. And I thought, you know, people never see a comic laugh. If we do our job right, we keep the straight face and they laugh. And so I said to the promoter, I said, instead of doing something big, can we just bring out four stools and tell stories and try to make each other laugh? And they were like, well, we can try it. We'll see if it works. And there was no way to rehearse it. And so the first night of the tour, we were in Omaha, Nebraska, and there were 9,000 people. And I was the fourth one up out of the four of us. And at the end of it, I said, hey, let's bring the other three guys back and, you know, just tell a few stories. And we had no idea if it was going to work or not. And we got to the end of it and said goodnight, and 9,000 people stood up. You know, we got a standing ovation, and we kind of looked at each other and went, oh my gosh, it worked. And so that was always, I think, our favorite part of it every night was just trying to make each other laugh.
So you mentioned Carol Burnett and some other comedians as your early influences and exposures to comedy. Who else were some of your early comedian influences, and who are some of the comedians you like to follow or respect today that are out there?
Well, you know, I guess it's probably politically incorrect, but Cosby was a huge influence, you know, not accounting for what he did in his personal life, but as a stand-up, I liked him because he talked about family stuff. He was funny without being dirty. And so he was an influence. Bob Newhart was an influence. Later on, it was Carlin and Pryor, but that was after I got headphones, so my mom couldn't hear what I was listening to. And then when I got into comedy, like Rodney Dangerfield was great about helping younger comics. And Rodney helped me a lot, put me on one of his HBO Young Comedian specials. Jay Leno was fabulous. I mean, I remember being an open micer, and Jay would sit there with you at the Waffle House at 1 a.m. and kind of lay things out and tell you what you needed to know. And so, you know, they were always huge influences.
So was there an aha moment when you realized, hey, I mean, it might have been when you were 10, 15 years old, I don't know, where you had the knack of entertaining, and whether it was making people laugh or just pay attention. Do you remember when that moment was, or kind of how that transgressed into you being who you are today?
You know, I remember, and I did think that you're either born funny or you're not. I mean, I think you can get better at it, but I remember as a kid, I knew I could make people laugh, but I never thought that being a comedian was a career option. And I would save up my allowance. I'd buy comedy records. I'd memorize them. I'd go to school and do them. Always got in trouble. Every report card was, Jeff talks too much in class, you know, because I'm trying to make people laugh. And I actually had a real job. I worked at IBM, and I was the guy that was always in the break room doing impersonations of the boss. And, you know, turn around and the boss is standing in the doorway. And a bunch of guys I worked with used to go down to the local comedy club, the Punchline in Atlanta. And they kept coming back to work going, Foxworthy, you're funnier than these people. You need to do this. And they entered me in a competition, not like an amateur night, but a competition for working comedians called the Great Southeastern Laugh-Off. And I'm like, oh, dadgum, I got to go write something. And I wrote 5 minutes about my family, and I went down there and did it, and I won the competition. And I just remember, I was scared to death, but a minute and a half into it, I'm like, this is what I want to do. This is it. This is what I was born to do. And, you know, I still remember telling my parents I was quitting my job at IBM. My mother's first question was, are you on the dope? Whatever the dope was. And I'm like, no, I really think I can do this. I just have such a passion for it. And 5 years later, I was on Johnny Carson, and the same mother said, you know, you wasted all those years at IBM. And I'm like, okay, whatever, Mom. You know, now it's such a great idea to be a comedian. But the crazy thing about it is, I've been doing it now for 37 years. I still love it just as much. How blessed am I to have made a fabulous living doing something I would have done for free? And after 3.5+ decades, I still love it. I still enjoy it so much.
Well, over those years, I'm sure you've played many different venues. One of your upcoming stops includes, as we mentioned, North Star Mohegan Casino Resort in Wisconsin on August 20th, as well as several other casino stops. Do you find the mood of audiences changes based on the venue? So, like, if you're at a casino show, is that different than a comedy club or a corporate event? And how do you adjust your content based on those situations?
Well, if it's just a regular concert, then, you know, people are, you know, they're just, they paid to see you. They want to see you. And it's the same at a casino, except at a regular concert, you don't have people sitting out there that have just lost $10,000. So sometimes in a casino, not the majority of the audience, but there's some that you're like, all right, it's going to take them a minute to change gears. And then like a corporate, you know, nobody's paid to see you. You're just the entertainment. So like with one of those, I'll kind of start slower and a little more deliberate because I'm thinking, well, there's people here that may not even know who I am. But kind of at the end of it, I always find if I'm having fun, then usually it ends up that they have fun. And it is fun. It's fun for me. I just, you know, making people laugh. And in fact, I was telling someone the other night, I said, you know, I never felt like laughter made your problems go away, but laughter is, it's like the release valve that keeps the boiler from exploding. You know, it's how we all let off steam. Laughter and live music. And you think about, for the last year, what are the two things that nobody's had? We haven't had laughter, and we haven't had live music. And those are kind of the great stress relievers. And so you've got a lot of entertainers out there that are just so itching to get back.
Absolutely. Thanks, everybody, for listening to another edition today of Gaming and Destination Celebrity Spotlight, brought to you by our friends at North Star Casino Resort. We're here today with world-renowned comedian Jeff Foxworthy, who will be playing at North Star this summer on August 20th, as well as several other casino properties throughout the region. So be sure to check out jefffoxworthy.com for the full list of dates on the tour. So, Jeff, we always hear about comedians and how they deal with different things, hecklers or noises in the audience, phones ringing. Is there anything that are any of your pet peeves when you're on stage that just kind of bothers you when you're up there? Or are you in kind of a black hole in the world of Jeff and you roll with it?
No, you know, I'm lucky. I've never gotten heckled very much. And I think it's probably because I'm not mean-spirited, you know. The thing that took a while to get used to, like in the beginning of my career, I made most of the big money that I made selling records and selling DVDs, and they would always make the announcement, you know, no recording of this, you know, no cameras, no whatever. Well, now when you're on stage, every third person's got their phone up recording you. And, you know, but of course now nobody sells comedy records. There's no need to because it's all over the internet. But as I'm on stage now, I'm thinking, Lord, this is going to be on the internet before I get back to the hotel tonight. And so that's a little bit weird, but you know, I've come to just be used to it. But other than that, you know, you kind of learn to make jokes. I mean, if somebody comes strolling in late, invariably they're on the front row in the middle. And so, you know, it kind of stops the show, but you learn how to deal with that. And I'm like, if you're going to be late, then I'm going to embarrass you and make you talk to me for a little while. So, no, I just enjoy the whole experience. And I've just missed it.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people did. And, you know, during COVID and the quarantine, we saw a lot of artists, more music artists, performing live streams, staying connected to their audiences and other creative collaborations that we saw, which were all really cool, really inspiring during the height of the pandemic. Did you tune into any of those, or did you ever look into doing any live streams or recording anything like that?
Well, I tried doing one early on where it was like it was for a corporate thing, and it was a Zoom meeting, and it was so bizarre to be doing stand-up, but I can't hear anybody laughing. And I'm doing 45 minutes, and I told my manager, I'm like, I can't do that again. That's just weird. I feel like I'm standing up in front of the mirror in my bathroom. But I had talked to friends that had done some of the drive-in things and all, and instead of laughing, you know, they're hearing people honk their car horns and whatnot. So it's been different for all of us. You know, the thing was, I had just before COVID hit, about halfway through 2019, is I decided, all right, I'm doing all new material, and I literally started from scratch where I'm going into a comedy club on a Monday night with 30 people in there with just no cards going, hey, is this funny? Is this funny? And I built up a new hour and a half, and I just got to the point that it was polished. Netflix was wanting me to do a new special, and I was just to the point of being ready to do that special, and then COVID hit, and I'm like, oh, dadgummit. And so at one point, they asked me, they said, well, do you think you could do it without an audience and we could just go in and put canned laughter? And I said, no, based on my Zoom call, absolutely not. You're not going to like it. I'm not going to like it. It's just going to be weird. And so, you know, I'm looking forward to, I've got all these new ideas out there that I know are funny. I just haven't had a chance to show them to anybody. And you have to, I have to apologize. My dog is barking. I've got a 4-month-old puppy, and I just came back in the house. And so we're sitting out on the back porch, and it's not your fault, but there's a squirrel halfway across the yard. So we've got to let that squirrel know, do not come close to this house.
Who wins, the dog or the squirrel?
The squirrel always wins. But the dog always has to try. You know, she'll in just a little bit, she's 4 months old, she'll take off running and the squirrel will go up the tree, and then we reset and do it all over again.
You mentioned some things you're working on and projects that are in the works. Is there anything you can share with us or that you're excited about that we can look forward to?
Well, I did a couple of years ago, I created a game. I invented a card game called Relative Insanity. And basically, I wrote 500 punchlines, and then I wrote 100 setups about relatives, about family. And so the setup might be, right before we walked down the aisle, Daddy leaned over to me and whispered blank. And everybody has 7 punchlines, and they just throw the card they think is going to get the biggest laugh. And that thing ended up being the top-selling game on Amazon. And so when COVID hit, I'm like, all right, I can't do stand-up, so I'm going to go write 4 expansion packs for Relative Insanity. So I've done that, and they're going to be out at the end of the summer, so that'll be fun. I've been drawing, something people don't know I do. I draw and I paint. So I've been drawing a lot during this time. And, got a couple of TV projects in the works, but everything kind of, you know, slammed to a halt. So hopefully maybe by the fall we can start doing at least one of those. So, you know, I enjoy staying busy. So this, and I've enjoyed this time. I'm like, for the past year, I'm like, oh, this is what it's like to eat in your own house on a Saturday night and sleep in your own bed. I didn't know what this felt like. So it's been nice, but it's time to go back to work.
Absolutely. Well, probably one of your biggest successes or that familiar to me anyway is the You Might Be a Redneck series. How did that come about, and were you surprised at how well it did?
Well, I was shocked. It started because, I mean, obviously I've got this thick Southern accent, and I grew up out in the country hunting and fishing. And so when I got into comedy, you know, if I go to New York or LA, the only advice I got was, yo, Jeff, you got to take some voice lessons and lose that stupid accent you got. And I'm like, well, where I come from, you have a stupid accent. And so I was stubborn about the accent, but I drove a truck. I wore blue jeans and cowboy boots. I talked like this, and it was always good-natured, but everywhere I was going, people were like, ah, Foxworthy, you're just an old redneck from Georgia. And, of course, before comedy, I'd never been out of the South, but as I was going around the country, I was like, well, this isn't just a Southern thing. This is 15 minutes outside of every city I was seeing rednecks. And so one night I was playing in a club in Livonia, Michigan, and after the show, we're kind of sitting around the bar at the club talking, and they're kidding me about being a redneck. Well, the club we were playing in was attached to a bowling alley that had valet parking. And I said, wait a minute. If you don't think you have rednecks in Michigan, come look out the window. People are valet parking at the bowling alley. And I went back to the hotel that night, never thinking it was going to be a hook or books or whatever. And I wrote 10 ways to help people tell if they were a redneck or not. And I went back the next night and tried it. And not only were people laughing, they were pointing at each other. And I thought, well, if I can write 10, can I write 50 of them? If I write 50, can I write 300 of them? And so I kind of put it into a book form. I got turned down by the first 14 publishers that I sent it to. And the 15th one, I sent it, and the guy said, well, yeah, come in. We'll talk about it. And I went in, and he said, you know, this is kind of funny. He said, I think we might try to publish this. He said, how does $1,500 sound? And honestly, Doug, I thought, I didn't know if he was asking me for $1,500 because I didn't have it. And he was like, no, we'll pay you. I'm like, well, then, yeah, let's do it. And I remember saying to him, we're sitting there, I said, how many do you think we might sell? And he said, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we didn't sell 5,000 of them. And I think that first book sold 4.5 million copies. So, you know, from then on, every time I saw him, I would say, hey, I'm glad you don't know anything more about the book business than I do. but, you know, I never saw it coming. He never saw it coming. And, you know, they were one-liners. They were easy to remember. They were easy to retell. And I think that's what made people gravitate to them. And I quickly found out the true ones always got the biggest laughs. And so, you know, when people would say, you know, how do you come up with these? I'm like, there's no research. It's my family and friends. I'm telling you. And so it was just always fun. And even at the height of it, it was 5 minutes out of a 2-hour show. But, you know, people remembered them. Like I said, they were one line.
Absolutely. Well, if you could go back and give advice to a young Jeff Foxworthy, what would it be?
You know what? Talk about the things you know about. Don't try to be somebody else and learn to write everything down. Because I think most people have the thoughts that comics have, because too many times after shows, people, you know, they'll come back to the dressing room and they're like, I've done that, or I thought that, or I've said that. And so you learn to grab these thoughts. I mean, everywhere I go, I've got 5 or 6 note cards in my back pocket. And I just learned to write them down, because you think you're going to remember it later, and you never do. So learn to write everything down and just be you. Don't try to be Jerry Seinfeld. Don't try to be Jim Gaffigan. Just be you and talk about the things that you know about. And that's the way it always works the best.
Excellent. So a few quick hits with Jeff Foxworthy. Kind of short answers, if you could. The first one was hobbies. You mentioned drawing and painting. Pets. You've got a 4-month-old dog there. What kind of dog is it?
It's called a Pomsky. It's half Husky, half Pomeranian. So my wife didn't want one that's too big, so she'll be about 25 pounds. She's smart as a whip. We're both taking obedience lessons. I look for arrowheads. I love to look for arrowheads and artifacts. Love to bow hunt, love to fish. So I've got a farm. When I'm not working, I'm usually tearing something up on a tractor somewhere. And I've got a 6-week-old grandson. I'm a grandfather for the first time.
Congratulations.
Yeah, man. My side of the family, we had 13 girls in a row, and we finally got a boy, and nobody knows how to change the diaper. But it's all good. If I had known being a granddad was this good, I would have skipped kids and just gone straight to granddad.
Favorite sports teams?
I'm an Atlanta boy. I was born and raised here. So the Braves, the Falcons, and especially the Georgia Bulldogs. I love the Georgia Bulldogs in college football.
Musicians or bands that you like?
Oh, my God. Oh, there's too many to... I mean, growing up, it was Elton John, Springsteen, Billy Joel, you know, that kind of stuff. But I listen to everything from 60s up till now. My kids are now turning me on. They're the ones that make me playlist now.
So any books or podcasts that you're into right now, or movie series or television series?
We're watching Queen's Gambit right now. I'm reading a John Grisham book. I read about a book a week. And I listen to a ton of podcasts. I kind of like the true crime ones. And I don't know why, but as a whole, comics are kind of fascinated with that kind of stuff. You know, the murder shows. That and Elvis, and don't ask me why, but most comics I know are fascinated by both of them.
Favorite place to vacation or visit?
I love my farm the most, but we lived in LA for about 7 years back started around 1990. And so we would go to Hawaii. Hawaii was awesome. Love that. Love Italy. Went to Italy. And if you ever go, Doug, try the spaghetti. It's so good. If you go to Italy, try the spaghetti. But I like to travel. I like to go different places. I've been to Africa several times, been to Europe. But if it was up to me, I would just go down to the farm and get it on a tractor.
Is there anywhere you have not been that you want to go?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, I want to go see Galapagos before I get too old and, you know, before that changes. And so we were kind of making plans to do that before COVID hit. So maybe, you know, when this is over, I would love to go see Galapagos.
All right. This one's a little off the wall, but a friend wanted me to ask you your favorite type of blue jeans, favorite brand of blue jeans.
Yeah, well, For most of my life, it was Levi's, but now, right now I'm wearing Buffalo because they have the, little bit of the stretchy material in them, the little stretchy waistband that, thanks to COVID, Daddy's loving the stretchy waistband.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. One last question. Being a gambling magazine based in Louisville, Kentucky, just up the road from you in Atlanta, have to ask, have you ever been to the Kentucky Derby?
You know what? I have not, and my mother is 85, and that's the one thing on her bucket list that she has never done. And so we may have to try to pull that off this year. And I mean, I was always on the road doing shows, but my wife said, you know, you've got to take your mom to the Kentucky Derby. So maybe we'll do it this coming year.
Well, we've hosted several, you know, celebrities and people. We've hosted your buddy Ron White several times. He plays in an annual celebrity charity poker tournament that I host every year. We'd be honored to host you and your mother or anybody any year.
Well, if you can handle Ron, you can certainly handle me.
One of his prerequisites is playing golf at the Valhalla Golf Course here, so we usually may set that up for him too.
Well, and I don't even play golf, so I'll be easy.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for your time, and thanks everybody for listening to today's Gaming and Destination Celebrity Spotlight with Jeff Fogsworthy, brought to you by our friends at North Star Mohegan Casino Resort. Be sure to catch Jeff at North Star this summer on August 20th. Check out JeffFoxworthy.com for the full list of dates for his tour. And Jeff, thank you for your time today.
You betcha. Thank you so much, Doug. I enjoyed talking to you.